what would you say is the most important tool in your kitchen? The one you literally cannot cook without? Well, sorry, it was a trick question because the tools we use, even the ones we absolutely depend on, are all cultural. And that means nothing is truly essential because cooks have been making great food using totally different tools than you or me since we climbed down from the trees. So Tim Hayward is a British food writer and an obsessive about the history of kitchen tools. And we talked to him about some of the ones people think they can't live without and about the ones that did kind of change everything. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Now, I love the idea that the tools we use say so much about us, often without us even realizing it. So the first thing I want to talk with you about is the chef's knife, because I think we think of getting a quote-unquote real chef's knife is, what makes you a real cook. I remember getting my first chef's knife. It was $65. And I thought, my God, I need to keep this for the rest of my life. Like, I'm a serious cook now. But you wrote that's a pretty recent idea. So how'd that happen?
I think it is. I think when you travel around and see people cooking in their own homes, and certainly if you think about your own sort of older relatives, there was no chef's knife, no chef's tool in the kitchen. They would use whatever was to hand and, cut sitting down at the table towards their thumb with a vaguely blunt knife in that really worrying way. And I mean, it's a big, dangerous thing, a kitchen knife. I mean, we don't have guns in my country, and when I put that thing on my table, I realized that that's a big, big piece of weapon steel I could do terrible damage with. I mean, even in sleepy Cambridge, if I took that thing outside on the street, I'd be tasered to the ground in 2 minutes. But, and yet we have this strange object. And that's a really weird thing to bring into your home. But I think really it just speaks a lot of the sort of the worship of the chef and how they started to become sort of celebrities in their own right. Elizabeth David, I think, was the first person in UK food writing who really said you should go out and get yourself one of these French carbon steel knives. But since then, I think we can't wait to see Gordon Ramsay doing that thing with the knife that he does on screen with the sparks go everywhere. I mean, the only thing you can be sure of is that's not his real knife, by the way.
in my mind then, because this was such a fetishized object and because, again, this quote-unquote made you a real cook, I did sort of assume that people always cook this way, even though intellectually I knew, I didn't see my... Well, then again, in my family we didn't use them, but because we use Chinese cleavers. I grew up in a Chinese family, so maybe in my head I was like, well, we didn't see them but for that reason.
It's really intriguing how the knife almost tells you about the place of cooking in people's culture. I have a knife called a Kai Dao that I use, which is a kind of... I guess most people would think of it as a cleaver. It's much lighter than an actual meat chopper would be. And I love it. I love using that. That's the general purpose knife of Chinese cookery. I've got a beautifully made one of those by one of the best manufacturers in the world. And it's still, it's a $50 item. And you look at it and you realize that in that culture, it doesn't have the precision elements of a high status tool. It's kind of it's a thing that's kept in the back room. It's almost like a servant-like function that the knife is used that way, or perhaps that it doesn't have the status built to it. And you compare that with a Japanese knife, which comes from a tradition of samurai sword making, and there's sort of a nobility in the blade. And then you look at a German kitchen knife, and it's made the same way as surgical steel would be made, and it's used by men. It has a male application to it because it's a tool and a function and near to a weapon. And all of those things, all of those codifications, give you so much of an understanding of the culture of the period and the background and the way people interact with cooking as a whole.
Yeah. And the fact that you have to stand up while using these knives.
Well,
right?
this is really weird, yeah. I mean, the book started in my head, I think, when I started trying to write some stuff about the history of the fitted kitchen. Because I couldn't work out why it was that we had this thing in our lives that was sold to us that was halfway between a room in the house and a piece of furniture. And there are two standard heights in the UK, one for the table you eat at and one for the table you cook at. I couldn't work that out. And at some point around the period of sort of the modernist designers, the Le Corbusiers, etc., they were thinking, oh, this is a working practice, the making of food. Therefore, you should have a bench and you should stand at a bench, like, as it would then have been, a man working in a workshop. And so you have a rack for your tools and you have a bench at waist height on which you operate. Now, that means that the chef's knife is absolutely useless without a chopping board. There are other parts of the world where people just don't have a bench. They cook around a fire. They cook around a pot. The standard working position is kind of squatting, and then you have knives where you cut either towards your thumb, or there's a phenomenon of guarded knives. You see these a lot in Southeast Asia, so it's like a knife, very much like a quick vegetable peeler, where the blade is concealed behind a metal guard, and you run it along the vegetable, and you don't need a chopping board to cut downwards and into it. And you can use it in any position, in any place, and you don't need the kitchen. It's a marvelous notion.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I just came home from a trip in Thailand, and so many of the traditional kitchens in Thailand are outside their home.
Uh-huh, absolutely. Near the fire, and you don't want the fire inside. That's it. Yeah.
Right, it's a totally different space, and that transforms the tools, that transforms your position, that transforms everything.
Completely. Yeah. I didn't actually get any photographs of the device to go in the book, sadly, but this will really bake your noodle. In traditional Indian cookery, the knife is mounted on a wooden block on the floor between your legs. And you take the object in your hand and you kind of bash the object on the blade. It's phenomenal. It's bizarre and brilliant to watch. An entire reversal of the way that people cut domestically.
Yeah. There's no like one right way to do things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's move on to something else. Something else that in your book that I thought, well, that seems super innocuous, but you say are super controversial. And that is the garlic press and that like little weird earthenware pot that my mom keeps her garlic in.
Oh gosh! Well, yeah, the role of garlic. This is the UK. Everything has a class ramification to it. We love our class system, and you know we can't wait to find ways to distinguish ourselves from each other. But the garlic press was originally designed so you could squeeze garlic without getting the smell of garlic on your fingers. Smelling of garlic would have been a lower class thing. It would have mean you were either a cook, God forbid, or you were one of those people that had cheap, awful food, and you had to put this stinking bulb into it to make it taste of anything at all. And so I think, again, it was Elizabeth David who wrote first about this. You had this slightly scornful attitude, which is actually, you know, of course you shouldn't use one of these ghastly lower middle class objects. You must display your bohemian creativity by embracing the garlic and loving the smell of it. And so you must press it with the side of your knife and sort of mince it with salt and things like that. And even now, I think food writers and food people are generally quite quiet people. But if you want to start a proper fight in a pub, you know, talk to another food writer about whether or not they use a garlic press. I mean, I use a garlic press, but I'm not going to admit it to anybody at all. That's our secret.
Okay, well, Elizabeth David wrote in the mid-century, right? In the 50s, I believe.
That's right. 50s into the 60s, yeah. Yeah.
So she is talking about you have to love your garlic, embrace your garlic, you know, that many years ago. Why is that still controversial now?
I think because...
Why are you getting into fights on weekends?
Well, she, for me, as a writer, I think she symbolizes a period of writing about food in the UK that was very much about upper class aspiration. And I'm of a generation of food writers that doesn't feel that way. We have so many different varieties of food from so many different cultures, from so many different social levels. I mean, you know, I had something for lunch today that was the peasant cuisine of a country, you know, the other side of the world. And I'm proud that that kind of thing happened. So I think a lot of the class distinction that was in that period, we want to get rid of. We want to avoid that element. And so I suppose I probably use a garlic press because Elizabeth David said I shouldn't.
Then there are the little tools that you say kind of changed everything. And it sounds like chief among these are the clock and the thermometer. What do you mean?
Oh, boy. Yes. Well, if this ties you into the entire history of cookbooks and recipes. So peasant people cook for themselves by kind of heating up the food over the fire. That was all there was. And, you know, you passed orally the tradition of how you cooked certain things on. But it was only when you start having kitchens in great houses and you have professional cooks working there that you have to start having some kind of principle of passing the message on. So in stately homes, there were apprentice cooks. In monasteries, there would be cooks who would teach younger cooks who would teach younger cooks, always orally. But the minute you start having recipes written down, you've got to have a different kind of notion of time. So back in the old days in a monastery, I would say to you, you young monk, if you want to boil an egg, you should recite 4 Hail Marys. And if you want to cook it a little bit more, you go a little bit more than that. If you want to go a little bit less, because that's the way it's always been here. And that would be fine. Now, if I'm writing a book about how to cook an egg, I've got to be able to talk about a different kind of time altogether. I've got to be able to talk about a standard minute. And so the minute you have timing, you can actually communicate between each other over greater distances, and suddenly a recipe makes sense. And of course, it's exactly the same with temperature. It used to be that you would talk about a hot fire, a cool heat, and medium, which was right. in between the two. I'm even thinking about recipes in the sort of 1940s that would talk about, you know, cook over a fierce fire, cook over a light. And they were using the term fire, even though they had gas cookers at that point. But there were only sort of the two settings, low simmer, hot sear. And that was it. But also, in a way, I think that causes a lot of the problems, a lot of the issues that we have with food, this notion of perfection. This notion that if I'm a half-decent writer, I should be able to write you a recipe whereby, if you've never done this before and you have no experience of this whatsoever, and it's from an entirely different culture of yours, you should be able to do it perfectly the first time you try it because I've written it so well. And that notion of perfection, it militates against everything I believe about cooking and I enjoy about cooking.
Yeah.
You know, you or I would work a different way. We'd find a thing that smelled interesting and then probably spend 2 weeks finding different ways of learning how to do stuff with it. There's not a lot of time. There's not a lot of temperature in those things.
And so the clock and the thermometer kind of pushed us into the era where cooking became science.
Exactly that. Oh my goodness, there's a place for science in food. But it's interesting that the science is necessary for a particular kind of communication.
Yeah. Now it made us have to assume that the food is objective.
Exactly that.
Well, you are what you use.
God, I mean, so how deeply philosophical does this get? How quickly?
Yeah, right. You know,
it does my nut in.
Yeah, it's wild. Thank you so much, Tim.
No problem. An absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Tim Hibbard's book is The Modern Kitchen, Objects That Change the Way We Cook, Eat, and Live. You can find excerpts from that book on garlic gear, timers, and knives at splendidtable.org.